You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 27th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Roosevelt Fellow, Mike Konzel, on his new book, Freedom from the Market. Also on the program today, the fever is not broken. Republicans in the Senate show their hand in trying to block the impeachment trial. Meanwhile, Biden announces an order of 200 million more vaccine doses, hopefully returning us somewhat to normalcy by the end of the summer. A Trump-appointed Texas judge at least attempts to halt Biden's moratorium on deportations. And the Department of Justice rescinds the zero-tolerance immigration rule that led to immigrant children being kidnapped by the Trump administration. Congresswoman Marjorie Greene is just 12 months out from liking on social media calls for an assassination of our political leaders, specifically Pelosi. Joe Biden reverts to ending federal private prison contracts, starts a moratorium on new federal oil and gas leases. The New York City pension fund divests from fossil fuels. That's billions of dollars. Tony Blinken confirmed as our next Secretary of State. And Redditors are destroying hedge funds and making some people very wealthy. Filibuster fight in the Senate just beginning as COVID relief negotiations continue. U.S. announces restoration of relations with Palestinians and resumption of refugee aid. And violent clashes continue between government forces and farmers in India. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today. Emma is here with me in between her day trading that she's doing on...
I did one. Look, guys, Reddit's saying Nokia is the way to go.
Emma came into the office today, and she's like, I checked Reddit this morning, and Nokia. And I'm like, really? And then she's now, Emma has now purchased the entire set, and...
I purchased a very small amount of Nokia stock, but, like, it's taking all of my willpower not to just refresh.
We will, we're going to have somebody on in the next couple of days, probably next week, is to explain what's happened. But the long and short of it is, some people on the social media, I mean, I don't know if everybody knows what Reddit is, but it is, I think most people do. It is a... old-timey internet bulletin board type of situation. Yes. A little bit. And there are, an investment group, they somehow figured out, and maybe this is public knowledge, I'm not quite sure, that there had been hedge funds which had gone short on specific companies. In one instance, it was GameStop. In other words, placing bets that some period down the line, the value of that stock was going to be less than it is now. They make an agreement contract to buy it at a certain price that they perceive will be less than it is at, or I should say that they're going to deliver them, I should say, at a higher price than they can get it between now and then.
Yeah.
And some Redditors went in and started buying the stock, drove the price of the stock up, which got other people on board, which drove it up even further. And these hedge funders ended up losing a considerable amount of money because they had to bow out, essentially, of their short positions.
And I think the shorts expire on Friday. I was just looking that up. So they have to then buy the GME stock in order to
fulfill the promises they made to deliver them at a lower price.
Right, because for their investors. And so that means that if you bought a significant amount of the GameStop stock, then you're going to get bailed out by that hedge fund that you kind of looted. So it's
there you go.
Incredible. It's nice to see regular people kind of taking this massive casino back. I'm sure there will be laws that preclude this in the future, but this is what people on Wall Street have been doing to regular people on a daily basis, and now it's just been democratized because of the internet. So getting while you can, I guess.
Emma will be putting out her stock tips every morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely
on our Twitter
not.
Feed.
So in addition to the sports show.
Exactly. Emma's going to be very busy these days. Impeachment, as we said, the article of impeachment was delivered the other day from the House to the Senate. And Rand Paul brought a motion to the floor to require a vote on whether or not the impeachment trial is constitutional in and of itself. And here he is delivering that.
This impeachment is nothing more than a partisan exercise designed to further divide the country. Democrats claim to want to unify the country, but impeaching a former president, a private citizen, is the antithesis of unity. Democrats brazenly appointing a pro-impeachment Democrat to preside over the trial is not fair or impartial, and hardly encourages any kind of unity in our country. No, unity is the opposite of this travesty we are about to witness. If we are about to try to impeach a president, where is the Chief Justice? If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him? Private citizens don't get impeached. Impeachment is for removal from office, and the accused here has already left office. Hyper-partisan Democrats are about to drag our great country down into the gutter of rancor and vitriol, the likes of which has never been seen in our nation's history.
Pause it for
one. Instead of doing the...
I don't know where Senator Paul was during the past 4 years when we talk about rancor and vitriol, but...
He missed that part.
Someone should probably let him know what's been going on in the country. And also what led us to this point. But let's hear a little bit more from him.
Nations work with their new majorities in the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. Democrats are wasting the nation's time on a partisan vendetta against a man no longer in office. It's almost as if they have no ability to exist except in opposition to Donald Trump. Without him as their boogeyman, they might have to legislate and to actually convince Americans that their policy prescriptions are the right ones. Democrats are about to do something no self-respecting senator has ever stooped to. Democrats are insisting the election is actually not over, and so they insist on regurgitating the bitterness of the election.
Okay, pause it. That is such an obvious straw man. Not one Democratic senator is insisting that the election is not over. The only people who...
Well, the Democrats won the election.
Yeah, the only people who insisted that the election wasn't over, that there was a chance that it could be changed, were the Republicans. They were the ones litigating the election for weeks and weeks and weeks. And you know what it led to? It led to millions upon millions of Americans believing that the election was not over. And what did that cause? The storming of the Capitol building where five people died. This party is talking about rehashing things. They did hearings for years on Benghazi when four people died. And we, all Democrats want to do is hold this guy accountable. It's not just about removal from office. That's ridiculous. If you commit a crime in Nebraska, you can still get tried for that crime. You can have to go back there. Just because he's left the office doesn't mean that he can't be held accountable for his crimes. It's ridiculous. Straw man after straw man. And the way he says it with such confidence is so infuriating.
It is. It's sort of shocking. I mean, it's clear what's going on here when you can see what happened to the 10 or excuse me, the 11 Republicans in the House that voted for impeachment. They are all now concerned that they're going to be primaried.
Mitch McConnell, get death threats.
Well, yeah. Mitch McConnell, put up a trial balloon in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago saying that he was happy about impeachment. Now it turns out that once that trial balloon starts to sink, he gets the sense that maybe the Republicans are not in the best position to throw off their base. And then this story that was about Mike Pence, who... Business Insider reported that former Vice President Mike Pence don't have any permanent residence and that they're supposedly moving from place to place. At one point in the report, it implied that the Pences are in a precarious position and that they are a little bit concerned about staying in D.C., because, of course, we know that this insurrection, one of the highlights of it, involved people running through the Capitol looking to either, I mean, they were looking, they were saying they were looking to hang Mike Pence, and they had built a gallows. So you literally have their former vice president trying to at least obscure where that he's living, ostensibly afraid of what is out there in terms of the Republican voting base. And you've got Rand Paul pretending that everything is just fine and we should just let bygones be bygones. It really is stunning. But that is your modern Republican Party. The fever, I think, seems to be still raging. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Mike Konzel. He is a director at the Roosevelt Institute. He's written a fantastic book, Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. We'll be back in just a moment with that. In the meantime, today's program, sponsored in part by Brooklinen. I cannot tell you, I literally received four pillowcases yesterday from Brooklinen. Yes, that I had ordered.
I love Brooklinen, and I have them for my everyday sheets.
They are, what do you mean your everyday sheets?
I don't know.
Do you have special occasion sheets?
No, I don't have special occasion sheets. I live in a studio, so I have backup sheets, like if I'm behind on laundry, and they're terrible,
okay,
and I don't like using them.
I see,
because they're not Brooklinen.
Okay,
right.
I understand.
Got
what
it?
You're saying now. Yes, folks, life is too short to sleep on anything less than really nice sheets, and Brooklinen has them. It was started by Rich and Vicky, who tried to find beautiful home essentials that didn't cost an arm and a leg, and they couldn't. So they started their own company, Brooklinen. It's the first to direct-to-consumer bedding company. I will tell you right now, Brooklinen sheets, Brooklinen comforter, Brooklinen bath mat. Is that what you call that? Like a bath rug?
Yeah.
Buy a Brooklinen towels. And every single one of those products I love. For me, they give you two options on the sheets. They have... I can't remember. It's percale, maybe? Is that what they call it? I can't pronounce it. It's the cool, crisp cotton ones. And then they have the other ones that are like sort of more, softer. But I don't like that.
Silkier.
Silkier. Yeah. No, I don't like that.
They're all soft, is the point.
They're all soft. But I haven't tried the other ones, but I like the cool crisp ones, the cottony ones, and they look great. I am very partial to the stripes. That's what I've been going for. Although I did get a couple of sort of the longer king size pillow. What do you call it? Pillowcases, because I mix it up a little bit. Solid stripes. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you do? I love these sheets, honestly. I've been using them now for, I guess, like 3 or 4 years. And it's time for you to do something nice for yourself in 2021. Help you do that. Brooklinen has a special offer. Go to brooklinen.com, use promo code MAJORITY. You get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY, get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping. Brooklinen.com, use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Also, folks, these days, I know that I started trying to take vitamins on a regular basis probably 5 or 6 years ago. These days, I'm a lot more vigilant about it. But one of the great things about Ritual multivitamins is that you can take them without food because they're time released. They have a delayed release capsules and they're designed to dissolve later, so in less sensitive areas of the stomach, I guess. So you can take them without food.
Oh, nice.
And for me, my biggest problem has always been I always forget. And I tried to do it like in the morning. I tried to make a ritual out of taking the ritual, but I forget. So when I get home, I can eat them. I can take them without eating food. Ritual also has a visible supply chain that they provide for you, so you know where your nutrients come from. They're available for women, for men, and for teens. They're scientifically developed to help support different life stages. And the best thing about Ritual, your multivitamins, they're delivered to your door every month with free shipping. So you can snooze if you want, or you can cancel your subscription at any time. If you don't love Ritual in your first month, they will refund your first order. And the beauty of Ritual is that there's no sugar, there's no GMOs, there's no synthetic fillers, there's no artificial colorants, no animal byproducts that you find in normal multivitamins. It's clean, it's vegan-friendly, and it is made with key nutrients that your body can actually use to fill the gaps in your diet. That's what Ritual is all about. You deserve to know what's in your multivitamin. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your ritual today. That's ritual.com/majority. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show without commercials, you get extra content in the fun half. And just a reminder as well, this program replays on the Choice channel on the Peacock app, 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. every day. You can check us out there. You get a little bit of upgraded graphics by the time we get on to
Peacock. And you can see us on your television, maybe. Right?
Yes, indeed.
Like,
or you can watch
quality.
It on your app, or app on your phone. But yes.
You can see how secretly bad I am at doing my makeup, right?
And how unsecretly bad I am at not using it at all. I'd like to welcome to the program, or back to the program, one of my all-time favorite guests, who I am so pleased now has finished his book, so he's going to be more available on a regular basis. Mike Ponzel, he's a director from the Roosevelt Institute, and he is now the author of Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back on.
So, all right, let's start with this. I mean, you've created a history, or I should say, you've written a history to that is in some ways a reminder, and to make it clear to people where we have been as a country in relationship to the market, that I think has been somewhat obscured over the years, and I imagine that's where you do too. But let's start with this idea of I want to start off just first with, if I could, give us a sense of, like, you know, what of where we started, or I should say, what is this idea of market freedom? I mean, where did this develop from?
So the idea of market freedom, by that you mean the more conservative ideology, the idea that so the kind of market fundamentalism, the idea that freedom should be like a market and markets are freedom, I think has always kind of been in parts in the country, but has really taken hold in the last 30 to 40 years. There's a lot of reasons for that. We can kind of go through some of them. You know, a general shift to the right on economics in particular is really what the book really wants to emphasize, is that that wasn't just a shift about saying that, you know, markets are better at this or that, which has often been a very bad bet, but that markets themselves should be thought of as like the highest form of civic participation. That markets have really come in to replace things like democratic accountability, public goods, public programs, and that this wasn't just about people trying to denigrate the public or privatize things or make a quick buck, so that's obviously very animating throughout all of it, but that people on the right and increasingly in the center left during this time period were really caught up with the romanticism of the idea that markets are the place where we are most free, where we're able to express ourselves. But markets are fundamentally a domain of inequality. They're a domain of winners and losers, and making sure that people can't get things unless they can pay for them or someone wants to sell things to them. And also in the workplace is a profound state of unfreedom. And those arguments have been with us for centuries. And, you know, a decade ago when I started to really think about this, I was just realizing what a lack of argument we were dealing with. And I really wanted to recover this history and put it in one place so people could engage it.
Can we start with, I want to sort of get these sort of broader themes out of the way so that we can go through these examples, some of these key examples that you give throughout American history of where we had a different relationship to the market and what it the benefits that it provided. But give us an understanding of what neoliberalism is. I mean, we hear this term bandied about quite a bit, and often I think it's misused in some respects. But you outline for us neoliberalism, and there's two elements to it, I think, that you how you would define it, and so that people can get a better understanding of what this concept is.
Sure. So neoliberalism is a movement by intellectuals and political actors to reduce the ability of democracy to check the market through affirmative state programs. And it's the era in which they were successful in the last 30, 40 years, the stage of capitalism that it produced. That's a kind of clinical definition. The term itself, it just gets really weird in the U.S. context, because here, just as background, here in the United States, liberal tends to mean like Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal and big government programs, where in Europe and elsewhere, it tends to mean more libertarian. So new libertarianism or a new wave of libertarian thought about the economy might make it make a little bit more sense to what it's trying to describe. And the book has two chapters on this in the last 30 or 40 years. And I think there's a lot of debate about the term. I think it's very helpful, but sometimes can get a little over-prescribed. I think there's two really important takeaways. One is that it is an affirmative project to remake the government to be more friendly and supportive to markets and to owners and bosses. I think there's a kind of commonplace thing by the right, and sometimes on the left too, that's like the thing is about getting government out of the way, or small government, or limited government, or but that's not actually what's happening. And in the chapter I go through, I talk about some of the public parts of the economy, the public corporation, the public domain, and the public utility, and how there was a real aggressive assault by conservative intellectuals over the last 30 or 40 years, with center left people helping them out throughout many of these decades, and stripping the publicness out of each of those, and in light of a theory of how the government and the market should work, that a public domain was privatized in increasing amounts and the public corporation was meant to just serve shareholders. And they are very aggressive about using the state in the process of that. That's what's new about it. And we see it with tax laws and global trade agreements and all kinds of things that are meant to limit democracy. The other half of that thing that's really important is that, and I talk about this with public colleges and student debt. You know, people forget that colleges were free for centuries, or nearly free. And, you know, just going through that in the book, I think is a good political education. But it was, the funding was privatized to individuals in the form of student loans. And that wasn't just solely about having this or that funding mechanism. It was meant to tell people that they should have a certain kind of expectation from their government. So the second part is that it's about creating a certain kind of citizen that is meant to only act with markets, with the state backing the markets. This can get kind of technical or kind of abstract, but I think we see it with student loans where it's like, it's not about education being free or education being something that should be available to people who want it. It's about an investment you make in yourself, and you should own the risks and rewards of that. And that's just fundamentally a different kind of citizenship than we've had in centuries past.
I think this is really important to emphasize, the notion that that this neoliberalism, which essentially comes out of Mount Pelerin, right, in the wake of World War II, and this idea that the state exists to support the market, because this concept, to understand this concept, takes us to sort of the fundamental concept and a recognition by libertarians that markets are constructed, right? And can we talk about that markets and that property? And maybe we can go back to the Homestead Act which you write about, that property is constructed. What does that mean?
Absolutely. So your house, like if you own a house, you don't own, I mean, you think that you own the house, the physical building, but you don't really. The house doesn't really care about whether or not you own it or not. Sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it's not. What it really is a means of managing relationships between people, that that you own your house in the sense that you can keep people from going onto it. And if they try to like sleep in your front lawn or walk into your house, you can call on the state to back that up. You can sell off parts of those rights. You can rent out the basement, and you can rent out the basement in such a way that they can't paint the walls. And there are ways to slice up those property rights, but that what you're slicing up is a relationship between people. And so one thing, I talk about the Homestead Act, which is obviously a really important part of American history. And it's very controversial, obviously, because it's built on settler colonialism. But one thing it makes very obvious, and the people at the time are very clear about, is that the property that they're arguing about is created by the state. People don't create land. They can only keep people on it or off of it through various parts, through the enforcement of the state. And so it's very interesting to watch that era of free labor, free soil, early Republicans, the 1850s and 1860s, talk about small-scale property ownership and land as being essential to good citizenship and keeping people free from the market dependency of wage labor. Those insights and in that idea that wherever there's a market, there's a state creating the terms for it, ensuring that contracts can be negotiated and executed, moving actual property and profits across locations and across territories. All these things are government enforced. The government is always creating the market. What people like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek started to do in the 1940s and 50s is really think, in response to the New Deal, which was a huge shock for them, in response to social democratic movements in the West, not just communism, they started to think, well, you know, we need a program that has a theory of what the state should do. We can't just say we shouldn't have a state because that's an anachronistic thing after the Great Depression. But we do need a state that would work to limit democracy and check its ability to have markets and have market actors profit and do what they want to do with their property, even though that property is still a set of relationships among people in relation to the economy as a whole. So it's once you read them, it seems very clear that that's what they're doing, but it's no less government action. And so when libertarians say that they're against the government, they sort of don't mean it, or at least they're a little bit confused as to what they're up to.
Right. I mean, the fact is that a property right, a property right cannot exist without a government to enforce that property right. I mean, it's really the government's enforcement that establishes that right in many respects.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially that's even more like, so one reason why I spent a lot of time with land in the Homestead Act, but because it's just an interesting history and it's a very different way of talking about the economy than we're used to out here, is that you set that with land and it makes a lot of sense. And that's even more relevant out here in the 21st century when we talk about things like corporations, which aren't a real thing. They're a legal entity. They're a legal fiction that hangs over buildings and work processes and things, ideas and intellectual property, money, which itself is backed by the government. The government can create whatever much it wants in a country like the United States. And you look at historical things that try to check that, whether it's the gold standard or the neoliberalism we live under now, where they actually try to force it so that only private actors, private profit-seeking actors, are the ones who can determine the extent of these relationships.
And I mean, tell us a little bit more just from a practical standpoint of the Homestead Act, so that people do get a sense of like what it means and what it represented at that time, as opposed to that is different from the way that we perceive these things today.
So it was a time. So the Homestead Act gave 160 acres of land to anyone who was willing to settle it. Anyone who was interested in becoming a citizen after the Civil War, including freed people. And it was, you know, 160 acres, you got it free. You had to be able to get to it. And it transferred a size of land, approximately the size of Texas and California combined, to settlers. This was in contrast to the frontier. And I want to be clear, obviously, it's built on the taking of land from Native American indigenous people. But the alternative was the extension of the slave power to the West. And this was really the fight in the 1850s, or giving it solely to resource extraction and corporations. And, you know, at this time, this is pre-industrialization, but wage labor is becoming more and more common. And people are reacting to it as a state of unfreedom. They don't like having bosses. They don't like having their working hours controlled. And so many people, like Horace Greeley and a lot of the early Republican Party members, argue that if you could give people land like this, that they could maintain their self-sufficiency. There would be markets. There, like, people could make crops to sell or to trade, but they wouldn't be dependent on wage labor in the market for their survival. And it's a pretty profound vision of freedom, and people keep coming back to it. It's also a different way of talking about wealth. Now we talk about wealth as this almost ethereal thing, or this thing that has like a deservedness quality to it in a lot of common conversations. Where here they understood that the wealth was being created through state action. It was just who was going to benefit how and what kind of citizenry would it produce. And though it ultimately could not overcome industrialization, and notably the Southern Homestead Act, which I go into, could not overcome white supremacy and terrorist violence in the South during Reconstruction, it's still a powerful vision that I think has resonance out here in the 21st century.
I mean, and to a certain extent, that's the story of much of your book, isn't it? I mean, it's like these were visions, alternate visions of what America could be, that there are very powerful forces that have a great interest in making sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of them are even more on the mark. So when I went into the 8-hour workday, free time is the second chapter, the arguments are just very powerful across the 19th century. The first probable general strike in the United States was in 1835 in Philadelphia for a 10-hour workday. And the language the workers were deploying in pamphlets and in written articles just are really amazing out here in the 21st century. They're arguing that they, as people who fought in the Revolution or are children of the Revolution, have natural rights to freedom and their own free time, and that no boss can have dominion over that. And it's a language of natural rights, which we wouldn't really use out here the same way, but just the idea that there's something about the workplace that is fundamentally anti-democratic and anti-freedom in the sense of it's encased with arbitrary domination. I think it's very compelling out here when we have people who work way too many hours to just get out of poverty, or can't work enough hours because there's not full employment, or importantly, for many places in service sector, they don't have control over their hours. They don't even know what their hours might be at the beginning of the week. And without that, you can't have communities, you can't have civil society, you can't have time with your family and friends. And I like that argument just resonates so clearly out here in 2021. I think kind of just demonstrating that people have been fighting battles literally for two centuries plus on how to control their working hours. I hope, give some ammunition and hope to people fighting those tough battles out here.
I want to get into the into Social Security and as well as into Medicare. But maybe this is a good time just sort of like to just take a slight tangent for a second and talk about you go over five reasons for that that freedom from markets are essential to being free. And maybe we should just touch on that, you know, brought up by that concept. I mean, I think you started the book with a quote from the 10-hour for the protests, and it's just sort of shocking to see people talk about that, which is, you know, about the relationship with work as being, you know, that I think many of us today perceive like, oh, well, that's maybe how we evolve to that concept, as opposed to that's from 150 years ago or so. So, I mean, give us those five reasons for freedom from markets are essential to being free. Like, what does it mean to be free? I guess we can start with.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key ones is freedom just requires being free from arbitrary domination. And I think one of the key things, the fifth one in the five, but is, you know, we talk about whether or not the government makes people more or less free, whether or not there's restrictions on speech or movement or political activity. And we understand that framework really well for saying this country is more or less free. But the market is just as much a government creation as secret police or, system of mass incarceration or other kinds of limitations. And given that the market is fundamentally bound up with limiting people's activities and managing activities among people, I think it's important to understand it as a component of freedom. So just like as we said earlier, there's no way to say like, okay, the government's over here and the market's over there. And then the government's the only thing that can really restrict your freedom. The market's way over here, or way over in some other place. It's the same activity. And so it's important to put the government's creation and execution economy under the same scrutiny we would put for any other things we consider about freedom, whether it's religion or privacy or so on and so forth. In practice, freedom requires being free from the arbitrary domination of others, the Republican theory of like a philosophical Republican theory of freedom. And, you know, in the workplace, in our communities, like we are subject to the decisions of others, whether they're our bosses, whether they're major platforms that surveil us online, whether or not they're people who may or may not pay for our health care, even though we have insurance. Like they have the ability to subject us to unfreedom in a way that is profound and has deep implications. Other reasons I go through is one is that the market.
Let me just stop you there, because the counter argument to that we would hear would be, well, you've made that decision of your own free will. You have decided to forego that level of control over yourself and subject yourself to the arbitrary whim of your boss, as it were. Because you're getting money in return. Why don't I have the freedom to give that up? I mean, what dictates that? How does that make that dynamic unfree in some way?
Sure. So one is that you have to work to survive under capitalism. So that absolutely introduces another element into it, right? So it's, you need money to survive in capitalism. You need money. You are dependent on the labor market, unless you happen to be rich separately. And as such, in order to survive, there's always someone who the boss who determines whether or not you have access to that wage is fundamentally in a position to determine quite a bit of your life outcome. So that's one entry point.
This may seem like sort of obvious to people, I think, who deal with this on a daily issue. But I think for a lot of Americans, we don't realize that is a choice that has been made, not necessarily by all of us. It's a choice that we have been born into on some level. And it's also a choice that we make to perpetuate that, because we have societies all around us in the world where those survival, and this is obviously what you write about here, is that those necessities that you need to live, let's say housing and food and healthcare, there are places where you don't need to work to have those. And you can enter into that agreement to give up control of yourself to your boss without that sort of coercion of not having the necessities available to you.
Exactly. The market relations build the coercion right into the labor contract. And as such, there's places where you can have better or worse relationships between workers and bosses. And let's be clear, like throughout our history, we've had even in nominally free market, like free labor contracts, like huge abusive feudal relationships. You know, the book talks a little bit about this, about how, you know, for a long period of time, especially before the Wagner Act and then the New Deal, you know, labor contracts were kind of feudal. Like you took, the worker absorbed all the responsibility. They ended up disabled, as a large number of people did in the early 20th century. If, you know, there was any cost, the workers had to bear them. They couldn't be hired away. They couldn't leave their job early. It kind of evolved out of almost master-serf relationships from like feudal era. And like, that's not, there's a way to introduce democracy into that relationship that I think is essential for freedom. And if you look, walk down the things like health, for instance, like us being healthy is in part based on how we're born. It's part based on choices we make, but it's also in part based on the environments we're in, the access to information we have and the resources we have. And you know, we talk a lot about this in the book when the creation of the idea of social insurance is that there's a level of security against wealth. So we know, and if we were relying on capitalism for wage labor, we also know that there are periods when we can't secure that. We're too young, we become disabled, we become sick, we become too old, or we're engaged in caregiving labor, which isn't compensated under capitalism. There's a way to insure against that in the literal sense of insurance that the government is the best at carrying out in terms of its scale and efficiency and making sure that everyone has access to it. And you know, the book covers a little bit about how like that becomes a predeterminant of freedom, that your ability to be secure in those periods when you're unable to work is reflected through the government's ability to provide that income insurance at scale and in a way that ensures everyone's included.
We talk about that sort of notion of what it would take to be to not allow the market to dominate us. And I do want to get to some of these, like the daycare example that you provide. But let's also, this is a good time, I think, to define capitalism, because, you know, in this era, there is, I think, particularly, I think, a large extent, because you know, Bernie Sanders has been in our loomed so large in our politics for two cycles now. There's been a sort of a focus on the definition of socialism. But I'd like you to define capitalism. Like what constitutes capitalism in your mind, and to what extent is that sort of can capitalism exist if you have markets that are not subsuming so much of our freedom?
Sure. So, yeah, it's been funny how there's been all these very large fights often within the left about what is socialism. Like, is Bernie Sanders socialism? Is Sweden socialist? And not enough about, like, what's capitalism? And it's like, what is actually capitalism? It was part of the fight over the 1619 Project is when they hinted that we should understand slavery as a proto-capitalist system because it had profits and financial instruments and certain kinds of record keeping. And people fought about that, but it's also like, okay, but like, what is actually capitalism? And I think sometimes people use this kind of functional, like, well, if there's banks and if there's corporations and if there's private, you know, like profit seeking, which I don't think it ultimately gets to it. There's a couple different definitions. The one the book really engages with, and the one that I think is really important for this story, is something coined, by a historian, Ellen Wood's argument about market dependence. That capitalism is where we are dependent on the market for the allocation of all goods in society. And you can take that to extremes, but basically, to the extent that you are able to survive and thrive, it depends on the ability of market actors to allow it or market relationships to carry it out. The dependency kind of reverses the idea of market freedom, that markets like are a cool place to thrive, because it's like, well, it's also a place where if you can't work, you're in a lot of trouble. Or if you are sick and have a pre-existing condition without regulations, like you are in trouble. So I like that relationship, that it's ultimately means that the market is the thing that is determining the allocation of all the key goods in our society. And it also provides a way in which democracy is a check on that. So you can have markets existed before capitalism, and markets will exist in whatever happens 500 years from now when something else is in place other than capitalism, whatever that might be. And trading for goods and profits, but the dependence of markets is the, and also I'd really emphasize almost the moral determinant of who should get what, not just the allocative reality. I think that is, one is, I think, a pretty accurate definition that helps us get a sense of the scope of capitalism. And also, I think what people are most most resistant against. You always see these things about, like, how can you be a socialist if you have an iPhone? That's stuff like that. And it's like, well, no, like, there are things that markets are very good at getting to people, like technological advances, but there are things it's quite terrible at, like care labor and retirement security and healthcare and control over your hours. And it allows people to engage in a critical discourse that doesn't get tripped up in, like, whether or not you should have, like, a fancy gadget or something.
Is that, I mean, from your perspective, is it more helpful to define capitalism versus, let's say, socialism? Do we have a, is there like a 51%, 49%, and that's, it's that binary, and we cross some threshold and we're not capitalists, or, that it starts getting very nebulous in there. I mean, when we, you know, like when we talk about, like you say, the Scandinavian countries or European, you know, different European countries. I mean, where, or are we just on some type of continuum, or is there even like a, is the one continuum just too narrow of a plane?
I think there's a continuum in many different directions, both in terms of in which ways the markets are in our lives. I think of it, continuum's correct in the sense, but I like the idea of a compass. Are we getting closer or further away from something? And if we're getting closer to market dependency and the rule of market logic, is that a good direction to go in this space? And, you know, you can see it in, even in the last year. You know, you look at what's happened to workers in California, where even the proto labor conditions that agree, that adhere to people, they are now more dependent because of these contingent worker clauses and things like that have passed. It's bad in the context that it makes them even more dependent on the market for what they secure, even things like a minimum wage or various forms of anti-fissuring. You look at campaign finance, which is like democracy is even more dependent on market actors and market logic. You suddenly start to see it in a lot of different ways. And I think it's the way it shows up across spheres, I think, helps us understand a little bit better what we're trying to get away from.
Okay. All right. So let's tell us the example of daycare in World War II, because I really want to get to this into Medicare, or I should say Medicaid, and what it did in terms of like integrating the Southern hospitals. But
yeah. So the story I knew a little bit about, it was so fascinating to dig into. Essentially, that we mobilized and conscripted so many men during World War II, and we were at such a high pressure economy, there was so much work that needed to be done, particularly in factories, that women were sent into the workforce very rapidly. And women had always been increasing their workforce participation across the 20th century, but here, going into government work and manufacturing and industrial work was sectors that they generally had not been working previously. And those were, high income, especially at the time, very high income. But, many had children, and no one to watch them. And so as part of the mobilization, the government dumped a bunch of money into daycares for workers in government in wartime facilities that they essentially created them within a year. It's crazy to see the scale of it. Hundreds of thousands of kids in good daycares within a year. Year and a half plus by the time it was like fully up and running. And people had really good impressions of them, like the surveys were bad. Some people were resistant to the idea of using them, but then once they used them, they enjoyed them and benefited from them. A big component of it that I thought was really telling, very relevant for our debates right out here in 2021, is up until that point, daycare had essentially been a form of stigmatized charity. They wouldn't even think of it as stigmatized, or they would think of it as a good thing. That like their job in providing daycare for women who needed them was that they were either directly social workers or doing social worker-like activity, where the idea was like to make sure moms were behaving well and keeping case files and doing interviews and essentially acting as oppositional agents to the family structure. Where here in World War II, the military had no interest in being social workers. They wanted bombers and they wanted And so they were like, if you can show up and work, we will absolutely give you daycare. We don't want to means test this. We don't want to keep records on you. And that was a transformative policy for the people who were able to, the women were able to use it. Because it just removed the stigma and just showed how well a program can work when they wanted to. There was also a lot of opposition to it, ranging from social workers to the Catholic Church, to conservatives, to a lot of moderates. And so they fought to keep them going and ended up keeping them going for a few years in some places a little longer, notably in California. And the fight is a very interesting one, full of all kinds of arguments about how daycares allowed women to have the freedom of choice into how to structure their families that the way they want it. And it's a really cool history. It's still very relevant, sadly, out here.
Why is it that we can only provide something like that if, you know, it is to pay for bombing people or fighting people? I mean, right?
I mean, like, we do things right when we want to. So, like, you know, the total warness broke. You know, so there you have the stigma around poverty and, you know, the stigma around gender relationships, right? So, like, the war required being flexible on patriarchy, and the war effort required being flexible on having large programs that could continue themselves if they wanted. And I think it's only like a little bit like the CARES Act and the pandemic, where you were paying people over 100% unemployment insurance replacement rates. Crazy times allow for policies to break through, and then it's a question whether or not you can continue them or find the coalition to build on them.
Talk about this element of Medicare funding to desegregate Southern hospitals. So this is fascinating, this dynamic between providing this type of semi-universal, I guess, program and its implications, not just in terms of economics, but race, or I think it shows that dynamic between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. So, President Truman tried to get single payer health care and it was defeated. And one of the things the government did was just dump a bunch of money in the hospital construction. So you had these federally funded hospitals all across the South to make up for disinvestment in health care and during the Great Depression, notably, and also the war. And those federally funded private hospitals remain desegregated until 1965. This is a decade plus after Brown, which should have required federally funded institutions to desegregate. It was a year after the Civil Rights Act, which prohibited, by definition, but in one of the titles, segregated facilities in public accommodations and also things that receive federal funding. Yet Southern hospitals remained segregated. They just refused in many cases, or more importantly, they were dragging out the process and kind of just lying and saying that they were doing stuff that they weren't. And it wasn't until the issue of Medicare funding, which was going to redefine the funding landscape for hospitals in the United States, came into being, that it was actually in a position to force change. Something a lot of legal scholars know that I did not actually know until I researched the book was that Brown versus the Board of Education didn't actually desegregate many schools in the South, because the courts are very good at upholding privilege and power, but they're really bad at dismantling it. They don't control funding. They rely on elite actors to carry out their work. There's a great book called The Hollow Hope about this. And so your ability to rely on the courts to dismantle things like white supremacy is actually going to be kind of limited. They're really good at reinforcing it, but they're really bad at limiting it. It wasn't until the Civil Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement that you could really have mechanisms that included administrative capacity and money to force change and you know, like punitive penalties. And so what the people who stood up Medicare did, in addition to just getting it launched in a year, which is totally crazy if you live through the 20-teens, they literally got Medicare up and running within 1 year. Also, one nice thing about universal programs, they mailed everyone basically a punch card saying, do you want this? Tell us, you know, confirm you live here. Do you want Part B? You have one choice, yes or no. It's $3. And then you got Medicare. as opposed to a website that needs to coordinate 100,000 different things. So that's a very interesting thing. But more importantly for this story is that the people who stood up the civil rights portion of Medicare were people, veteran fighters of the civil rights battle, who worked with community activists and Black medical professionals to create a network of people who went out and ensured that hospitals were desegregated. And the ones that didn't were threatened with funding and virtually all of them before and then all of them after back down. And Medicare, the threat of not getting Medicare funding forced desegregation. And it happened in a very quick pace. And it happened with the certainty that you would not have gotten through random lawsuits or just trying to wait it out or public pressure. The ability of the government to provide a program really does ensure, can, if it wants, ensure that everyone has access to it.
It's fascinating to me because as you talk about the power of affirmative action by the government into the market and its ability to sort of change, you know, which would seem like a bank shot, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, like, you're going to take, we have an opportunity for you to take Medicare patients. And it's another to say that we're going to change your exclusion of a certain group of people through Medicare payments. There's this dynamic of, like, the invisible hand is really not invisible as much as it is obscured, right? And it is hiding what its agenda is, whereas the government is at least we're explicit about what that agenda is. We can see what it is, and theoretically, at its best, it is democratically determined on some level.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the most pernicious things about Jim Crow's ways that intermingled civil society and a white civil society and private actors and public profit-seeking actors and the government as a background, right? So, like, all these hospitals in the South were public-private partnerships, though not legally. They were receiving public money in the sense that they were getting employer-provided health care, which is a tax expenditure, that they were receiving funding, that they were treated as private employers to ensure that the federal government could not get in the way through the federal funding component. And the courts took a very slow course with the hospitals. And it's the ability of a public program to cut through that mess of self-reinforcing segregation, I think, is really powerful. And it points to what programs can do now if we want them to. And they could have also designed it to not do that, too. They could have just paid it out. Or what they were really worried about was them just saying, like, oh, you know what, like, promise us in 5 years you'll get it. And then they, of course, 4.5 years later asked for a waiver. And this was, like, the real worry. And so there's ways that public programs can also reinforce it if you don't actively make the choice not to.
We just have a minute or two here. And I know that, so much of your work has come out of your experience in the Occupy movement. Which now almost, I guess, 10 years ago. Give me a sense of where you think we're headed. I mean, with the Biden administration, are there green shoots, as it were, some indication where you have optimism, where you see, or maybe better phrased, like, what do you think is the most important thing that we're seeing that could lead to sort of making people more aware of this relationship with the market?
That's a really good question. So, obviously anyone who's lived through the last 12 years has politically in particular, has a couple thoughts on this. A few things. One is that it seems like there's a lot of movement towards moving faster and bolder and more publicly than simply through private actors. So you look at the big top-offs and direct checks individuals and unemployment insurance in particular, I think, have been very encouraging. I think the fact that you can go back to talking about, like, lowering Medicare age or expanding the public option or trying to find better ways to leverage Medicaid are all more publicness programs than solely trying to work through the private actors and the ACA exchanges. And how they'll balance that would be a good question. For me, most important is that in terms of the moment is full employment. I think, we look back at 2009, 2010, the move that was predetermined really to go to austerity. Like, it wasn't just Republicans that forced that one. I think people understood what a big mistake it was on one hand. And then on the second hand, even in 2016, people in that time understood, like, there's a big fight about whether or not 4.5%, 5% was full employment, whether or not the economy had recovered as much as it was going to. In 2016, we should kind of just be okay with that. And, in 2019, unemployment got below 4% for maybe a year or two. I was at 3.5% for 6 months before COVID. that's shocking to people who lived through that period. And I had always been very bullish that unemployment could get very low. And I was like even shocked by it. So I think the sense that there was a real fumbling about the two most important questions about the scope of the ability of the government to react and the how far you could get towards full employment. The fact that both of those were whiffed pretty hard, I think the people really want to make up for that, which I'm encouraged by.
Mike Konzel, the book is Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. Really fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, quick break. Be right back. I could have spoken to him for another hour.
And
there was so much in there. There's so much, in that book that I think is a really important read for folks. And his point about this broad elite consensus, not even elite consensus. I think he conceded that he shared in some of that in terms of what the lowest rate of unemployment we could have was without sort of the economy overheating. It's good. I mean, we're going to see that in the way that the Fed reacts to the things, and the idea that we can continue to put money into the economy as a government until people are recover from what has been an enormous economic shock. And I think the other thing that he didn't have a chance to talk about was the there was a broad elite consensus about the concept of deficits and debt, which I think is also gone by the wayside. All right. That's it for us today. We'll be back with more tomorrow. See you then. And for those of you sticking around, I could have talked to Konzel for another. We'll have him back on soon. But I can't recommend that book more. Really important to both.
I'm excited to read it. I am.
It's important to sort of get these concepts of stuff that show the bounds of what we can do and what we have sustained in real time. But it also, I think, people to understand this relationship with the market and I love the idea too of sort of getting a sense of what constitutes capitalism, because it's so binary in our conversations that we have in this day and age as to, that there's some massive divide, let's say, between Elizabeth Warren saying that she's a capitalist to her bone, which was obviously sort of like a little bit of a sop.
A little bit.
And Bernie Sanders, saying he's a socialist. I mean, the differences between them are not so dramatic. And I think some socialists would say, well, that's because Bernie Sanders is not actually a socialist and whatnot. Yeah. But the real question is, at least in the context of where we are at this day and age, what constitutes capitalism and what parts about it are problematic? And I think, that notion of having to enter the market with this sort of coercion is a big part of it. It is, and the way that you deal with that is to decommodify some, if not all, of these things that we need to exist. And
I think the conflation of markets with capitalism is unhelpful, I think, is a short way of saying that.
Yeah.
The coercion, that goes back to the wage system. I mean, I just reading that 1710 diary of the slaver Byrd II. He wages are something you give to the servants who aren't slaves, right? And that's that system is basically where we're at still these days. And I don't know. I think particularly in the context of what we talked about with Astra Taylor and student loan debt. I mean, a lot of these structures of control, they're just more mass and more. than they used to be, but it's the same kind of impulses of power, basically.
Right. And that, you know, and we didn't have a chance to get to that with him, but he's got some great, he does some great writing on that dynamic of the difference between, the difference in the coercive relationship between, having access to university that does not saddle you with debt, vice versa. I mean, we talked about that in sort of slightly other terms, like you say, with Astor Taylor. But so much of it is about the relationship between the players within the market, right? You enter the market and you already have healthcare, and you enter the market and you already have housing. You enter the market and you already have the option of an education that does not burden you with debt. You enter the market and your children are cared for when you go to work, it changes the relationship between you selling your labor and the person who's purchasing it.
Yeah.
And look, we know, I mean, and this is what the neoliberal project really is about, is on the other side of that ledger, from the people who are buying your labor, government does many things to ease or to add to their bargaining power by providing limited liability in terms of when you enter these market, either requiring or not requiring certain working conditions that you must provide, maybe providing infrastructure for your business in a way, like, you know, the building the roads for a corporation that is selling a product is the functional equivalent of providing free daycare for a parent who's going in to, you know, negotiate their contract with that company. You know, it's just sort of like, you know, what is that dynamic between those two entities that enter into the market? And it is way out of whack.
I think COVID really revealed a lot of that with all the concern last summer about, are we paying too much to people in this COVID relief to make them stop going to work, right? That's the fundamental thing we're concerned about.
And increasingly, I am convinced that this is sort of an obscured part of the healthcare debate. That it is, I mean, yes, insurance companies stand to make a lot of money, but, you know, I think it was Matt Brunig who pointed out, like, this is not a massive industry. You know, it's like a $30 billion annual industry. It's not a massive industry that it should have this type of power in and of itself. There's also, you know, there's also the hospitals and the providers and the doctors. But I'm also convinced that there is a hidden incentive for large corporations, but broadly speaking, that it adds a certain amount of control and power in that negotiation between the worker and the owner, the manager.
When your healthcare is dependent on
when your healthcare is dependent upon it, and I think, you know, that is, I think that concept is a little bit obscured in that debate, like that notion of, because it's always mystifying. Like, people are like, well, I don't understand why corporations aren't lining up to have the government pay for healthcare. And to a certain extent, part of that is because, well, it may free up folks to be a little bit more, I guess, picky and have a little more power in that negotiation. All right. We got to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. We went long today. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, today on the Nomiki show.
It is Nomiki's birthday.
It is?
Yes, it is. I just texted her before the show.
Gosh. Wow. Nomiki, happy birthday. I hope she hears that. Today on the Nomiki show, Brendan O'Connor, Jordan Zach Aaron, Simon Narod. Maybe I'm not pronouncing that correct. You can watch her at 3 p.m. on YouTube or on Twitch, twitch.tv, the underscore Nomiki underscore show. I just like giving that one out. Also, don't forget, check out the Antifada. You can find it on twitch.tv/theAntifada. They're doing like two or three streams a week now on the Antifada. And you can also find it at patreon.com/theAntifada. Matt.
Yeah, literary hangover, folks. As I mentioned, The Secret Diary of William Byrd II. We did his 1709 entries. Check that out. Interesting stuff there. We also talk about his relation to a descendant or an ancestor of George Washington and Robert E. Lee. You know, how they kind of, we, as Prager points out, that's an incestuous slave aristocracy there. And we go into a colorful character that those guys descended from. So check that out on any podcast feed you like.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. We're going to head into the fun half. We also can IM the show. People ask, how do I IM the show? Well, you pick up the app, majorityapp.com. It's free. You can use it on your iPhone or your Android. And of course, we sell all of your GPS data to the government.
Obviously. That's how the show makes money.
That's basically what moves us along. A lot of people think like, oh.
The ads, they're just, you know, dressing.
That's just a way to obscure the idea that we are selling all that data. No, in fact, we don't. We don't have one of those DK or PK packages. I don't know what it is, but Kyle has explained it to me. He's very, very sensitive about it. Kyle has like no apps on his phone because of that.
Interesting.
Yeah, he won't.
No, I'm like such a target for targeted ads. I'll like look at, you know.
Well, it's not just targeted ads. They take your GPS data and they'll sell it to the government. They'll sell it to hedge funds who are like, we or like holding companies like we own a, you know, a mall company. Where should we put a mall? Well, we can look at this data and it's broken down and we can tell like where people where the key place that people go by every day.
I don't like this.
Yeah, sorry. Well, that's the upside. We just haven't been able to get on the ball with our app to do that. So you can IM the show via the app. Find it at majorityapp.com. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Fucking reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, black.
black, black, black African, and the alpha males are black, 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 and the Africans are black, 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 black.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't not hustle.
Come on! Fuck them, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.